You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 27th of October 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House, with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, Bond is back.
007 reporting for duty.
Where the hell have you been?
Enjoying death.
We'll be reviewing the latest Bond film, Skyfall, with critic Jasper Rees.
Also coming up, we'll be looking around the world for some cultural highlights for the weekend. Our special focus this week, Milan.
Milan's fall cultural lineup is in full swing, and this weekend marks the opening of a new piece of participatory art by Argentine artist Tomás Saraceno.
And fashion writer Sarah Moore will be joining us in studio to talk about fashion on film.
I wasn't a fashion editor, I was the one and only fashion editor.
She saw things in people before they saw it themselves.
And if all that weren't enough, we'll be joined for our music review by the British DJ Chris Coco.
So lots to look forward to on this week's review here on Monocle 24.
And welcome to Studio One here at Midori House, where Gillian DeBias has been filling her cultural spare time with dance.
Well, I have. Ever since we talked about Dance Umbrella, I thought I have to see more dance. And I went to see Michael Clarke last night at the Barbican. And actually, at the end of a week, a busy week when our world is full of words and print, it was divine to just see movement and bodies moving and dance and fantastic contemporary choreography.
It's had quite mixed reviews. Some saying that when Michael Clarke does his very simple movements at their best, they're brilliant, but there are sort of slight gaps in this production. This is a production that almost doesn't have a name, does it?
It doesn't have a name, but I don't think it really matters. I just think his choreography is so clever that it's almost hypnotic, and seeing what the potential of the body, the potential of the human body, and the physique of these bodies. They're like Rodin sculptures. I think actually the choreography is amongst his best. I think it was really, really powerful and great music. I mean, from the beginning, which was very 80s pop to kind of a rock and roll sort of.
This is a very self-conscious fusion, isn't it? Because he's got Green from Scritti Politti and then Jarvis Cocker's sort of alter ego, Relaxed Muscle.
Which I didn't know. So I'm going at the end of the performance going, you have great music. And they said, yeah, Jarvis Cocker was great, wasn't he? And I go, what? That was Jarvis Cocker.
Because he comes. How much of a sort of a conscious mix on stage is there with the music and the dance?
On the second half of the second half, it is quite conscious, but I think it's almost better you don't know it's Jarvis Cocker, otherwise it would take over from the dance. But there's delight in knowing it afterwards.
My cultural week was a decision to watch more television.
Great, because we're going to be talking about that
later. We will be talking about this
in
just a moment. So yeah, the season has turned, ladies and gentlemen, here in London, so I have turned indoors.
Well, more talk with Emma on that. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
London has been enjoying its moment in the sun this year, and this week has seen the return of another English cultural giant. A certain alpha male spy has been celebrating his 50th year serving Her Majesty's Secret Service in film form.
Having leapt from a helicopter with the Queen for this year's Olympic opening ceremony, 007 is back with what many critics are saying is the finest Bond yet. Well, joining us in the studio to give us his take on what he's seen on screen this week is critic Jasper Rees from the Art Desk website. There has been so much anticipation for this film when you were at the world premiere. So is it one of the best Bond films yet?
Do you know what? I can't recall ever having seen a Bond film that I've enjoyed more.
Oh,
So what can you say? Yes, maybe it is. It really is a superb film.
Why?
Well, I don't want to. I'm extremely conscious. And you mentioned the London 2012 opening ceremony, which Danny Boyle, when they had the rehearsals, asked everyone in the stadium to not to tweet about, so that there would. The show was a great reveal when it came. And I was acutely conscious of being in this among 2,000 people when the world premiere happened 2 weeks ago in Leicester Square in London, that everyone felt that there were so many wonderful kind of surprises in the film that you shouldn't really leave the cinema and start talking about them. So I don't know what I can say.
Except that it was great.
However, we've got to talk about
it. Thank you for coming in, Jasper. It's been lovely to see you.
No, there's some... it's just a wonderful reinvention of a very tried and tested formula. One of the great things about this film is that we've got a very kind of craggy Bond who has come back from... he hasn't been on screen for 4 years. And Daniel Craig definitely does look older than his last time out. And so that's been written into the script, that he's this kind of old dinosaur, really, of a bygone age, and he looks like it. So he and that's written into the script. But they've made a virtue of the fact that MGM had a big debt crisis in the second half of the last decade, which means that they've not actually spent as much money as they normally would in a Bond film. And so one of the great things about, well, certainly me for a Londoner, and I think lots of us who saw it in London, is that it's a very London film. There are some great locations, mostly in Southeast Asia, to excite the large Chinese fandom for the film, but there's a lot of London in it, and London looks absolutely fantastic in this film.
There was a point where I think it was in the 70s and 80s where Bond films were just becoming a set of set pieces as a travelogue, a sort of Michael Palin with guns and girls. You didn't necessarily have a plot, because I couldn't tell you the plot of many Bond films. I can remember set scenes.
Yes.
Now, does this have a coherence to it?
It does have a real plot. The plot rises out of the contemporary anxiety about real security issues to do with leaking of information, secret files. The WikiLeaks thing is sort of there in the background, and of course Muslim terrorism. Although it has to be said that the villain, who is the best Bond villain in an extremely long time, played by Javier Bardem, Raoul Silva, has nothing to do with Islam. I'm not going to tell you who he is or what his motivation is, but it feels like a very, very coherent story, and it brings Judi Dench's character M, who is usually a sort of in-and-out figure in the film, much more centrally into the narrative. I'm not going to say more than that.
What do you think? It's directed by Sam Mendes, who's has such a strong theatre background here. But in terms of his films, he's made all his films in North America. Coming back to England to make this, what do you think that adds to the Bond?
Well, I think the thing that Sam Mendes adds is he just brings real quality. This is, he's spent most of his life not in film but in theatre, and theatre is about storytelling through character, amongst other things. So there's an incredibly strong sense of character. So you know who all these people are, and you care who all these people are, which is not
rare,
not normal in a Bond film. I never really cared about Pierce Brosnan's film. In many ways, he was the perfect Bond, because he was this kind of this pin-up, and also this kind of great big macho hulk. But somehow Daniel Craig and he brings a great deal more to it, and he brings even more with Sam Mendes at the helm.
It was apparently a decision that was made in the audience of a theatre a couple of years ago, that Craig and Mendes went to see a production on Broadway, and they were just chatting, saying...
Yes.
Sam Mendes, without actually fishing, said, "Who's directing your next film?" And Craig went, "I don't know. Do you want to do it?" And Mendes found himself after 5 seconds going, "Yeah, okay."
Brilliant.
And then suddenly that's the way it happened. Sam Mendes, I read, was also said that he was had this enormous problem when he was given the Bond film, insofar as he was given a list of everything that he had to include in it to make it a Bond film.
Yes.
So he went about making a film and a plot first, and then shoehorning the Bond elements in to make it work. Did you get that impression when you saw it?
You do. Although the thing that I've always found with Bond films is they always start wonderfully, and the locations are often great, and the female characters are very kind of picturesque, etc. But this time, as indeed has happened in the other Daniel Craig Bond films, is that you don't end up with the massive... Well, you do have a shootout at the end, but it's not Bond shooting lots of people in orange overalls, as it usually is, which I always find just horse-tranquilizingly dull. And but there is a shootout, but it takes place... It takes place in Scotland rather than, in a a bunker, which is actually a film set.
Let's have a little listen to what this film sounds like.
...007 reporting for duty.
Where the hell have you been?
Enjoying death.
I only have one question. Why not stay dead? There's no shame in saying you've lost a step.
I'm your new quartermaster.
You must be joking.
Also PPKS 9mm short. It's been coded to your palm print, so only you can fire it. Less of a random killing machine, more of a personal statement.
Q.
007.
I want to meet your employer.
Be careful what you wish for.
Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Well, I at least have got goosebumps.
Have you seen it yet?
No, not yet.
Tonight.
On our way.
Enjoy.
You mentioned a moment ago the old idea of Bond girls. This, by all accounts, has a focus shift, that you now have Bond women, as the Bond girl Naomi Harris has said. Yes. And also the key focus is on M this time round.
Yes, it is. It's giving too much away to say why it is. Mm. But her operation as the leader of MI6 comes under scrutiny, shall we put it like that. And Naomi Harris is wonderful as this, as a kind of gun-toting sort of Bond apparatchik, but there's a terrific reveal at the end of the film about who she actually is.
Part of the fun of watching Bond film after Bond film after Bond film is a bit of the cheesiness, the same lines, the same themes, but political correctness sort of also came in the way. Has that been turned down in terms of some of the what was thought of maybe sexism and unpolitically correct elements?
Well, the fact is that the political correctness is sort of, one could say that it's been enlarged upon by downplaying this notion of the Bond girl. There is a Bond girl in this film, but as has happened in other Daniel Craig films, the Bond girl is a slightly different figure, mm-hmm. has a slightly different role to play, I feel a real. It's not a great way of doing radio to say I can't talk about it, but it really is. There are so many wonderful surprises in this film. I'll say that there's a fantastic moment where Tennyson turns up, which is a beautiful surprise. It adds an extra layer of class to the film. There's even a hint of homoeroticism, which is definitely a new thing for Bond.
There is something that I wanted to ask you about. We're talking about the reinvention of sexuality and whether it is a very macho film. One thing that I've always experienced when I've been to see any kind of Bond film, regardless of who my friends are and how slack our waists are when we're going in, when we all come out, all the men have a bit more of a testosterone swagger and all the girls feel as if they can run round a corner and whip out a pistol. It makes you feel bigger and sexier than you probably really are in your real life. And it's a perfect fantasy film. Do you still get that from Skyfall?
Definitely. I went straight to have a martini shaken upstairs immediately afterwards. I really did.
Oh, you really did?
Absolutely.
Marvellous. So you do go out feeling, despite the fact that this is all a reinvention of, the idea of Spider. And also, moving on from that, although we're all feeling sexy and all pumped up and Bondy, has Mendes reinvented the genre by taking away, what was it, the day of the exploding pens have gone? The fact that it's all gone a bit more cyber and a bit more subtle, does that take away from the lovely gimmicky aspects that we've all enjoyed of Bond?
Well, the gimmicky aspect is taken over now by the fact that it's a much more computerised universe in which Bond is operating. So there's lots of kind of techie stuff, but it's much more screen focused than actual little bits of hardware. And there's a lovely line that Q has, a very young Q, played by Ben Whishaw, who he gives him a pen or something. I can't remember if he gives him a pen, but he says something. He actually says, I'm not going to give you an exploding pen, for God's sake. So his expectation, they're undercutting previous versions of or previous ideas of what a Bond film meant all the way through the film. One of the lovely things about this film is that there is a sense running through it that Britain has seen its finest days, and there's a wonderful elegiac quality to it, which is actually rather moving.
They often say, you know, you get the art you deserve. And I'm wondering about the films you deserve are society. How this Bond film, let's say in 20 years' time, in 40 years' time, will kind of reflect where we're at now?
Well, it's odd that it's coming out in this year where Londoners and the country in general has had a great sense of self-renewal because of the Olympics and because of the Queen's Jubilee, that this sense that we actually can do things. And this is a film about that questions the idea that we can still do things, that we're a society under threat from invisible forces. There's very much the line running through the actual plot is that we no longer know who our enemies are, that they are invisible. So how that story will play in 20 years' time will be very interesting to see. I'd be very, very doubtful that they'll ever unearth a better Bond villain, though, than Javier Bardem, who is wonderful.
Jasper Rees, I'm afraid time has run out on us today. Thank you very much indeed for coming in and giving us your thoughts on Skyfall. Let's hear
My
from
pleasure.
Adele. Adele's theme to the new Bond movie, Skyfall, there, ending our review of this week's films with Jasper Rees.
If I have the privilege of being your president for another 4 years, I promise you I will always listen to your voices. I will work every single day to make sure that America continues to be the greatest nation on earth.
I'd like to be the next president of the United States to support and help this great nation and to make sure that we all together maintain America as the hope of the earth.
As the countdown to the US elections continues, Monocle 24 is heading to America for a series of election specials. Every day until Election Day itself, Midori House will be coming to you live from New York City. I'll be joined by a host of political guests for an hour of news, debate and analysis on the world's most exciting elections. So join us every day on Midori House for Monocle 24's election specials. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and I approve this message.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Emma Nelson.
Time now for Monocle's Associate Editor Nelly Gocheva to talk us through some global cultural highlights in our weekend look ahead.
This weekend in London, we suggest Jørn Tomter's new exhibition, I Love Chatsworth Road. Norwegian photographer Tomter's love affair with Hackney in East London began in 2007. In his latest exhibition, he celebrates Clapton's transformation from green fields to city streets with a series of urban portraits and daylight stories that document his emotional connection with the city. It is on until the 28th of October. Check out the new 3031 Trans Arts exhibition in Tokyo this weekend. The show kicked off earlier this week, featuring the latest works by creative agencies Kayak and Party, web portal BioArt Japan, and arts performance group Contact Gonzo. The show is organized by the 3031 Arts Chiyoda Center, and it is named after their bilingual magazine. The show is on until the 2nd of December. Guido Harari's Sonic America new exhibit in Milan celebrates his work for the last 40 years. On show are photos of pop-punk pioneer Patti Smith to genre-defining artists including Lou Reed, Tom Waits and Bruce Springsteen. The exhibition is a must for anyone with an interest in popular music photography. Sonic America is on until the 20th of November. In cinemas in London this weekend is Russian director Andrei Zviagintsev's new film Elena. His latest title, after his award-winning drama The Return from 2003. The film follows the story of lead character former nurse Elena and her estranged wealthy husband, all set in the backdrop of post-Soviet Russia. And for this weekend soundtrack, we suggest the new release from Kylie Minogue. Kylie has ditched the electropop and moved into London's Abbey Road Studios to re-record her hits with a big band orchestra, as well as a few new numbers too. Let's hear Flower. For Monocle, I'm Nelly Kucheva.
Wrapped in a blanket of hope, asleep in a bed of dreams. My step into eternity is not what it might have been. Well, not at all, for who knows which way the wind is gonna blow. I'm waiting for your gentle whisper. Distant child, my flower, are you blowing in the breeze? Can you feel me as I breathe?
That was Flower from Kylie's new album, The Abbey Road Sessions, which is out on Monday. And if you're in Milan this weekend and want to hear all about the things happening in the city, we'll have an in-depth look ahead later in the show.
It's Saturday here in London, so you must be listening to The Review on Monocle 24. Time now for our weekly music review. And I'm delighted to say that today we're joined in the studio by Chris Coco. Chris is a DJ, broadcaster, producer, musician, journalist, all-round musical factotum. Welcome. Very, very nice to see you, Chris. Just briefly, I've said basically you have a finger in every musical pie. What are you currently working on?
I suppose the main thing is Melodica related stuff. I do a weekly radio show called Melodica, which goes out on a lot of stations around the world, from Australia to Poland to Turkey, and you can find it online at Mixcloud, and that's kind of turned into, in the last year, has turned into a record label, because I was being sent a lot of interesting music that wasn't being released, so I thought may as well, at the worst time in history to start a record label.
For those of us who haven't heard Melodica, what kind of music is this playing?
It's based on electronic music, so house, electronica, dubstep, all those different variations, but there's also a bit of acoustic and experimental weird rock stuff as well.
When you say you're being sent music, is there any area in the world where you're surprised by how vibrant the scene is and interesting music coming out of?
I think the amazing thing now is that there's music coming out of all from everywhere in the world. And there's a whole massive scene happening in India and China, which I don't know nearly enough about. And I think the problem with us in the West is that we still view music as being a mainly Western thing, and I'm as guilty of that as everyone else, so I need to go out there and do some more exploring, definitely in Asia.
Are you finding though that increasingly, because of the fact that your music goes on, is streamed on the internet, and the Melodica podcast each week becomes global, that a record label is what naturally follows suit for lots of podcasts of this type?
I think now you have to be doing all the things. You have to be doing a radio show, a label, going out DJing where you're getting immediate feedback and meeting people all the time, going to festivals, because you can't make enough money from any one single job. So you have to have about six different jobs that all kind of feed into each other. And then hopefully out of all that, you make a living.
And where are you DJing at the moment?
All over the place. I'm going to Hong Kong for New Year. Tonight I'm DJing at the Bedroom Bar in Shoreditch, so it's quite a big variety of stuff happening.
I'm interested when you say the Bedroom Bar, the importance of venue and different venues instead of just DJing at, you know, clubs that look like clubs. How important is venue and the originality of the space for you?
I think the venue kind of defines what music you play. I used to play at a little bar in Soho in London called The Player, and that was kind of quite kitsch and done up like a 70s kind of front room. And because of that, you end up playing a lot of slow disco music and going back to the 70s and 80s quite a lot. And people kind of seem to expect that because they're in that space. So I think the venue does affect the music a lot. If you're tuned in, you're that kind of DJ.
Well, what will you be playing tonight, and where are you getting your music from? Is it chiefly from what people are sending you? Because I get the impression that if one were a very lazy DJ, one would just sit and wait for people to bring the tunes to you. How much of an adventure do you still have going out and getting the best tracks?
I think if you are a DJ, it means that you're obsessed about music, which means you enjoy finding music, which means you spend a lot of time, especially now, online late at night with a glass of wine.
Drunk DJing is great.
Trawling around various sites, but also online shops, trying to find the latest little hit. I mean, it's basically like being an addict, but you're addicted to music.
But it is an absolute labyrinth out there. It's you will never find the end of this particular path, because when you start looking at one website, then everybody has a link to their own websites and their own DJing and their own attempts at mixing. And do you think now that we're getting into a situation where, because everybody can DJ online and because everybody's posting their own remixes, that we're almost losing our quality control a bit?
Totally. But that's why my job is more important than ever, because somebody has to be a curator. Someone has to go through a lot of this stuff and find the best bits and present it to you so that you don't have to do that, because no one's got time to do that.
Well, you've been curating some tracks for us. The first one that you wanted to play us is Jimmy Edgar, Let Yourself Be Free, from Detroit, legendary area of techno, which is now enjoying a sort of a second-generation revival, it's called. Tell us a little bit about Jimmy Edgar and why you've chosen this piece of music.
This is interesting. It's from a new compilation, which is put together by Derek May, who's a legendary DJ from the 80s, from that first wave of Detroit techno. And Jimmy Edgar is a new guy who's been around for 3 or 4 years making new stuff. So when he was born, Derek May was out there DJing, and then he ended up DJing with Derek at various underground parties in Detroit. So he's carrying on that tradition of electronic, soulful electronic music coming out of this dying city.
Well, let's take a listen. Jimmy Edgar, Let Yourself Be Free. That's the choice of Chris Coco from Melodica Recordings, DJ and musical curator and owner of Melodica Recordings record label. We were just talking while we were listening to that about how we think that music has sort of come a full circle in terms of genre at the moment. And that sounds an awful lot like the stuff that you were listening to late 80s, early 90s. But the production values, it just sounds like someone's put it through a better machine, basically.
I think that's pretty much true. I think what's happened is that people who are now 20 are rediscovering old, dusty vinyl 12 inches and treating it like rare groove, like something special from the past, and being influenced by that, and then using their computers trying to make it sounds like this old stuff that was made with machines, but obviously they can't quite do that, so they end up with something like the track we just heard.
And what's happening in Detroit? Is it enjoying a new breath of life?
I haven't been there ever, in fact, unfortunately, but I love the music from the city. But musically, yeah, there's a lot of really amazing music coming out of Detroit again. I don't know how much of a scene there is actually in that city.
I was interested, the compilation is called We Love Detroit, and I'm wondering, it's a very broken city. Do you think interesting new music often comes out of broken cities?
It seems to be the way, doesn't it, that when people don't have lots and lots of things to do, they get together and make music. And but the weird thing about Detroit is that it's not angry music. It's kind of warm, welcoming music, even though the environment isn't warm and welcoming. But maybe you need that. You need to go into a little basement and get together with people and huddle together and keep warm and get happy that way.
It was a precursor to slightly harder techno, though, but it always seemed to rescue itself. It never got quite nasty and dirty enough, did it? It always left you feeling quite happy.
I mean, that's what I like. I've always liked music that has some kind of soul and some beauty to it.
Well, let's move on to your next choice of track. This is your own. It's a celebration of a year of Melodica recordings. That's a compilation of your label. This is you and Synchro, My Desire. Tell us why you've chosen this.
Obviously, because it's one of my tracks. I like it.
You're allowed.
Synchro is a guy from Manchester, again, a new producer who's come out of the British dubstep scene, but is doing something that's influenced by ambient music from Brian Eno onwards. So it's this great mixture of, like, young guy from Manchester, older bloke from London, Lisa Lindley Jones, who's a singer from Dark Horses, which is like a goth band. So this big mashup of different styles.
How did you all meet?
On the internet, you know, just by, again,
it's like a glass of wine again, wasn't
following
it?
Following different routes, and then you end up talking to someone, going, "Hey, I like your music," and they go, "I like your music, and why don't we do a track?" It's as simple as that.
The online love fest continues. Let's have a listen. This is called My Desire. And that was Chris Coco and Synchro and My Desire, the choice of Chris Coco, who's our guest on today's review. Chris, that's obviously chill out music. What is happening with chill out music at the moment? It always was one of those things that was... It went quite wrong, didn't it? There was just far too much of it that was bad.
There is a lot of really bad stuff. What happens with every single sub-genre in music seems to be, it starts off being exciting, people collect together music from all over the place and it's really broad. Then people work out a sound, which they think is the sound, and they decide to make that. Then you get 1,000 copies of that sound and it all goes wrong. We've got 1,000 copies, but there's also a massive range of really interesting new stuff happening from all the different genres. And the job really is to find all those different styles and put them together in some kind of set.
It is quite hard to actually make it stand out from other genres. Is the fact that you took two other people who had completely different backgrounds from yourself to sort of bring something new to the table? Is that what made it a little bit different for you when you're putting this together?
I think so, yeah, because it has to be exciting for the people involved, and getting the Rhodes piano sound and the boring sounding drums is not exciting. So you've got to have this clash of different cultures and ideas, and then you come up with something fresh.
You wanted to mention a new London band, speaking of something fresh, that you've just discovered in London Bridge. Tell us about them.
Basically, I went to... My son was involved in an art show in a warehouse in London Bridge. He was showing some of his photos. And he said, "Oh, yeah, Dad, there's a couple of good bands on as well." And these guys were there in the middle of this massive warehouse space playing what I thought was amazing music, and I kind of slowly edged to the front with all the teenagers and started jumping up and down in a slightly embarrassing manner.
I must ask you this. For someone who's so closely involved in the music industry, are you an embarrassing dad?
You have to ask my kids that. Hopefully not. I think you have to be. You are a little bit, aren't you? You can't help it.
But. Because it must be impossible for your children to say, you know, my dad is really uncool. Because you are still.
Yeah, but maybe
quite
that
cool.
In itself is uncool. I don't know.
Oh, no. You lose every way.
Yeah.
Well, tell us, it's the band is called what? Harriket?
They're called Harriket, and they're a 4 or 5 piece, depending on what they feel like. But what I think is that at the moment there's this crazy hype around DJs, basically blokes turning up in big warehouses and putting their arms in the air and playing really bad music and getting paid vast amounts of money.
That's been the case for about 3 decades.
Well, no, but it's actually worse than ever. And for the first time, it's taken off in America, and it's completely ridiculously out of control and really rubbish. So the next thing that's going to happen is a return to, in the electronic music world, a return to bands.
That's, and will this happen underground, or...?
This is what I think.
This is what you're hoping
And this
for.
Is what I'm hoping. And bands like Haraket are taking influences of dance music from the last 30 years and dance music now and turning it back into a live experience, which works really well.
Well, I'm afraid, Chris, we have run out of time. Before we introduce Haraket and their track Taint, let's say thank you very much indeed for joining us here at the studio.
Pleasure.
That was Chris Coco from Melodica Recordings, DJ, musical curator, embarrassing dad. He is a multitasker par excellence. This is Haraket and Taint. Don't work without it, the sticks in the sea. And that was Haraket, a new London band, and their track called Taint. That was a choice of Chris Coco from Melodica Recordings, our guest today. On The Review, you're listening to The Review. It's just coming up to 12:44 here in London.
Well, early in the show, Nelly Gacheva gave us a run-through of the week's cultural highlights around the world, and we now focus our lens on one city. And today, our in-depth look, we're off to Milan. Here's our correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, to talk us through what there is to look forward to if you're in Milan this weekend.
Milan's fall cultural lineup is in full swing, and this weekend marks the opening of a new piece of participatory art by Argentine artist Tomás Saraceno on display in the city's Bicocca neighborhood. Presented at Hangar Bicocca Gallery, a factory once used for assembling locomotives, Saraceno's On Space Time Foam is a site-specific installation, 3 stories tall, made out of a thick, clear film. Visitors will be able to climb inside it, turning a living space into a sort of living organism, according to the artist. Those wanting to stay in the city center can opt for Palazzo Reale, next to Milan's Duomo. Over 200 paintings, drawings, and sculptures chronicling the output of Pablo Picasso will be on loan until early January, while the Musée Picasso in Paris undergoes renovation. For a quick refresh of major events in the 21st century, there's the Cassandra exhibition at the Palazzo della Regione, a short walk across the square from the Picasso show. Photo essays chronicle China's working class, images from Cairo's Tahrir Square during the Arab Spring, and feature the doughboy figures of Fernando Botero, whose drawings revisit the shocking images of the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Lastly, those wanting to get their groove on this weekend can book a seat at Milan's Teatro Nazionale to watch Saturday Night Fever, the musical. Dialogue in Italian with songs sung in English. For Monocle, in Milan, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. We'll be back after this to assess whether the latest trend for fashion documentaries is a seasonal throwaway or a timeless classic. Stay with us.
London, Tokyo, Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto. On October the 19th, Monocle opened the doors to its newest shop. Chock full of our regular goodies from Porter bags, Ettinger leather goods, 2013 Diaries by Marx, and Hakisan ceramic wine cups. Check out all of our collaboration products or flip through the latest issues of the magazine. Find the perfect gifts for Christmas or just a treat for yourself. Visit us on College Street in Toronto or at our other shops around the world. And remember, you can sign up to our weekly bulletin at monocle.com to find out about all of the newest products as they hit the shelves.
Mm-hmm.
It's Saturday. You must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
One of the gems discovered on the festival circuit this year is a documentary chronicling the life of the larger-than-life fashion icon Deanna Vreeland. As fashion editor of Harper's Bazaar for 25 years, then editor-in-chief of Vogue, Vreeland's career has had an enduring influence on the world of fashion, beauty, art, publishing and culture. During her first 50-year reign as the Empress of Fashion, she launched Twiggy, advised Jackie Kennedy, and coined some of fashion's most notorious proverbs. It was Vreeland who trumpeted the bikini as the biggest thing since the atom bomb.
Well, to find out if the documentary does do justice to its subject, and more generally to find out how well fashion translates on film, I'm delighted to say we're joined in the studio by the fashion writer Sarah Moa, contributing editor at American Vogue, and ambassador for emerging talent at the British Fashion Council. Welcome, Sarah, as ever, to The Review. You are the ambassador for emerging talent at the British Fashion Council. At the opposite end of that scale, we have Deanna Vreeland, who is...
Yes, I can't say I live up to her.
She's the cornerstone, basically, of an awful lot.
What she also was really very much about was discovering new talent and... new imagery, and always moving on. The documentary is named "The Eye Has to Travel," and that really sort of captures what she was about.
So tell us a bit more about the documentary from an insider's point of view. I mean, sometimes I think there's a danger because fashion is so much larger than life and the characters are so much larger than life. These people can be parodied. But knowing her and knowing the fashion world, how do you think it came out, this portrait?
Well, all I know is that that film has been... has caused a point of pilgrimage when it's been shown at the Curzon Cinema. Every single designer I know has made his or her way there to absolutely lap it up. Can fashion be caricatured? Yes, and fashion people can be caricatured. I mean, indeed, they have been for years. A funny face was made with a Diana Vreeland figure in there. But I think that these documentaries, the Vreeland one and the Valentino one and the September issue, which is the one that which looked behind the scenes that tracked the making of American Vogue, shows how serious the industry is and what kind of work and drive and passion and perfectionism goes into it. And I think those three really do the industry justice.
You mentioned all the designers went to see The Eye Has to Travel.
Mm-hmm.
What did they learn from it?
I think it just it lifts everybody's eyes to what to remember what they wanted to get into fashion for in the first place, which is discovery and daring and going to the nth degree to make something absolutely beautiful, because it's a new and daring and things which are not just servicing shops. So it's that inspiration that really had people coming out sighing and dancing, really.
I mean, people often say that, you know, you can judge an economy by the length of a skirt length, mini versus midi. But there is something about this film where, you know, it's really not that long ago, but when you look at what she was putting in the pages of the magazines, there is a great social history there.
Yes, and she was absolutely spot on in... kind of giving birth to the look which epitomised the time. If you look at what she did when she was at American Vogue in the 60s, she started there as editor-in-chief in 1962, and she kind of invented or named the youthquake when the Beatles came over and Shrimpton and Bailey, and she shot Twiggy.
Edie Sedgwick was always, as well. She sort of discovered Edie Sedgwick,
yep.
Didn't she?
I mean, she was this point in fashion where she made models into personalities and personalities into models. She says that in the documentary that she shot Barbara Streisand, who, of course, had a huge
nose.
She loved flaws. She herself had flaws. She was not a beautiful woman. She made herself incredibly chic and drove all her creativity through matters of appearance. And so, yeah, she did. You can see the times changing through her through her pages, right back from when you look at her work in at Harper's Bazaar. Carmel Snow, the legendary editor of Harper's Bazaar, picked her up in 1937. I mean, Vreeland tells these, sometimes they sound very far-fetched stories about how about her life. But she said that Carmel Snow saw her dancing at the St. Regis, and she, Diana was wearing Chanel, of course, and Carmel Snow came up and said, you know, you obviously know about fashion. And Diana says, oh, but I never get up before lunchtime, but I perhaps I could do this job. I don't know.
The film, I mean, it's made by the wife of the granddaughter of Vreeland and based around some interviews, one-on-one interviews that were the source of her biography. And the beauty of it is that there are some extraordinary quotes from her, and she is almost like the Oscar Wilde of fashion in many ways. Do you think they had to, in many ways, reenact some of what she said because the recordings weren't good enough quality? Do you think that worked in the film, in the documentary?
Well, I think yes. When people have been the recipients of the of the quotes, once heard, never forgotten. I think there's a hilarious moment where Bailey's talking about her sort of shrieking, but stop, the English are coming, or something like that. and Manolo Blahnik tells an amazing story about how she directed him to become a shoe designer. I think he went and there were some fashion looks and she said you should design for the extremities or something. Yes, I think it, I mean, I think it does work. I mean, she's, her quotes are very improbable, some of them.
Let's have a listen to a little clip of the film.
The fashion world changes all the time. You can even see the approaching revolution in clothes. You can see and feel everything in clothes.
Mrs. Vreeland really brought us into a modern period and knew that fashion and the world were on their way to something much more global.
I wasn't a fashion editor. I was the one and only fashion editor. She saw things in people before they saw it themselves.
And that was from Diana Vreeland, The Eye Has to Travel. We're talking about the film with Sarah Moa, contributing editor at American Vogue and ambassador for emerging talent at the British Fashion Council. Just listening to Diana Vreeland's voice there, this depth, this command of authority. One sort of one's spine straightens when one hears her voice. And when we're examining more broadly the idea of fashion documentary, that made me think of the September issue, which I was watching it again last night and I suddenly realised how prickly a character Anna Wintour is and how, I don't know how much of an inspiration she is in the same way that Diana Vreeland was. Is that me just getting the wrong bit of the fashion documentary?
I think that R.J. Cutler is an amazing filmmaker, and the way he's cut things clearly makes certain scenes look more dramatic. I think Anna, I can tell you that working for Anna Wintour only makes you want to do your best. And that's why people like Grace Coddington, who's sort of the equal figure in the September issue as it plays out, has worked for Anna since they were together at British Vogue, and she walked in. She was hired by Anna on the same day that Anna started her job at American Vogue. So, yeah.
Do you think it's hard to make a documentary like this while people are still living in a way and risking almost being more reality?
It was hard when that was being made. Everybody was terrified in the corridors, and Grace Coddington famously didn't want to have anything to do with it.
And she becomes the star of the film.
And what actually happened was that, yes, she became the star of the film. And even now she's stopped in the street by hordes of kids wherever she goes. And New York, Paris, London have seen it. And due to that, she's now written her autobiography, which is coming out imminently.
And as a result of the characters in the likes of September issue still being alive and still working, how difficult do you think it is to make a documentary which is factually correct to an audience that is not only inside the fashion industry, but to the lay viewer as well? So you portray an accurate portrait, but without making
life too difficult for the people who have to continue their job the next day? It is always a very tricky balance to strike, no matter what the industry is with this. You have to show, not necessarily warts and all, but you have to also...
make it entertaining.
Make it entertaining, make people want to watch.
Well, I think in this day and age, everybody goes into every project like that with extreme care, because you do have to live with stuff that you've been seen saying or doing. But that's the fact of life, you know, with tweeting and twittering and everything every moment. So I don't know that that's particularly a problem.
And with you working in the industry now, if there's one figure that you think would be worthy of a documentary, who do you think would you like to see unfold on film?
Well, I'd just like to see lots more of this kind of documentary, because I think when you have a really great filmmaker, brilliant. This industry is so rich and so deep, and I think this is only the beginning of a series.
Sarah Moir, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on today's review.
And that brings us to the end of our Saturday review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilbao. Our researcher was Fernanda Augusta Pacheco. Our studio manager, Toby Hammond.
If you enjoyed today's show and cannot wait a week for the next show, don't forget to listen to the new Culture programme with Robert Bound here on Monday at 1900 hours London time. All of our programmes are also available to download at iTunes or monocle.com. But from me, Emma Nelson...
and Gillian Tobias.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening.